Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, you're listening to Politics on the Couch. I'm Raphael Baer, regular host of what has become, once again, a somewhat less than regular podcast. After our record-breaking run of weekly episodes earlier in the year, it's all gone a bit sporadic again. Sorry about that. My excuse is that I've been busy publicising a book I wrote. Did I mention that I wrote a book? It's called Politics, A Survivor's Guide, available in all good bookshops. Well, oh, surely you know that by now. There's a book out. Do please enjoy it. And in it, there's a chapter, chapter 11, in fact, all about political journalism. How it works, why it sometimes doesn't work, what it means to be an insider, and whether it's healthy for democracy to have a special clique of extremely well-connected hacks with a political equivalent of the VIP access all areas wristbands you get at festivals. It's called a lobby pass. I've got one, as it happens, and I'm very fond of it for what are probably obvious reasons. It's very handy having privileged security clearance to swan around the Palace of Westminster at will, but I'm not unaware that what's useful and fun for me and my colleagues might not be the best metric of a healthy relationship between power and the press. In fact, that's what that chapter in the book is all about. And it's a conversation I've also often had with a friend of mine, someone I got to know in the lobby over many years. Journalist and writer I respect enormously. His name is Robert Hutton. Rob to his friends. And since you're a Politics on the Couch listener, and he's going to be our guest this week, you now count among his friends. The podcast hasn't dealt much with a practical business, let alone the psychology of political journalism and the lobby, and it struck me that Rob would be a great guide. He's a highly experienced news reporter. He's sat in countless Downing Street press conferences, travelled on planes with prime ministers, huddled round spokespeople. He's been to the White House. He's wined and dined ministers. He knows the ways of the strange tribe that is the lobby. He's also a great writer, by the way, author of a number of engaging and entertaining books, including, most recently, Agent Jack, an account of the extraordinary true story of how the UK security services secretly monitored Nazi sympathisers during the Second World War. It turns out there are a lot more of them than is commonly remembered in the stories Britain prefers to tell about its war record, but I didn't get Rob on the podcast to talk about the war. We may have mentioned it once, but I think we got away with it. This is a podcast episode about journalism, politics, truth, lies, corruption, integrity, and proximity to power. It was recorded a few months ago, so a few things have changed since then. Most relevant to our conversation, the final report of the Privileges Committee into Boris Johnson's lies to Parliament came out. Guess what? Turns out he is a massive liar. We kind of knew that when we were recording the podcast, though. It's a point Rob has made various ways in his extremely funny and often very poignant pieces for The Critic magazine, for whom he is the parliamentary sketch writer. And that's where our conversation starts, with me asking him to explain what that actually involves.
But so not everyone knows what a parliamentary sketch is. I mean, the sort of the famous sketch writers are Simon Hoggart, Matthew Paris, John Crace. And the idea is you do a report of Parliament that somehow, by giving a bit of colour and a bit of flavour, is truer than a dry report where you just said the Prime Minister said this, Leader of the Opposition said that. Tory MP said this. You try to convey what it felt like to be there. And it has generally become, you try to convey what it felt like to be there with jokes, partly because actually when you, as you know, when you're actually sitting up in the press gallery, we're all quite tightly packed in. What happens is that there is a sort of little whispered running commentary going on between all of these bodies where, you know, the prime minister will say something and somebody will, so your person next to you will sort of pass a remark. Yes, well, he would say that, wouldn't he, sort of thing. And so actually the flavour of being there is often funny.
I mean, it is often funny, but also you're right. There is a very particular idiom to Parliament, which is about the mood in that, you know, that tiny cramped chamber. You know, on the big set piece occasions, it's over full with people. And you're right. There, one of the protagonists in the political drama is the atmosphere in the room. And it's something that, and things that aren't necessarily going on center stage. So it's not necessarily about, so yeah, it's the thing where if it's prime minister's questions, yes, obviously there's the exchange between the prime minister and leader of the opposition. But if a particular MP is very agitated and wants to do something, you see that in the corner of your eye. And it's quite interesting seeing someone bobbing up and down to try and catch the speaker's eye. One thing I'd compare it to, if when you go to see a football game live, like the thing that you can never see unless you never really get when you watch the highlights or you watch it on TV, is the little sub dramas that unfold. You know, at a certain corner of the stadium, there might be a bit of niggle between a defender and the away fans because they've one particular tackle that they saw particularly closely and knew about. And he might, do you know what I mean? There's all these little things, yeah, little subplots that you as a sketch writer can say, actually, this is really what's happening in Parliament around this. This is how we're learning something about politics. But it's a very specific idiom.
When Tory MPs were starting to lose faith in Boris Johnson, there was a PMQs where they just didn't turn up. That wasn't, I think, obvious on TV because there are all sorts of rules, apart from anything else, about what they're allowed to broadcast in terms of wide shots and tight shots. And they're not, that it's not like football. The BBC aren't allowed to say, actually, tell you what, give us the cameras over in that corner. That's much more interesting than the person who's speaking. Is this little row going on between these two people here? They're basically quite constrained. But when you sat there, you thought, where have all the Tory MPs gone? I think it was around Partygate, and they'd all just we never quite got to the bottom of whether it was organised or semi-organised, or all of them just woke up that morning and thought, I can't bear to go and sit behind him and cheer. I think probably it was at least semi-organized. But that was the sense of, oh, he's lost the dressing room. You know, if he can't even get his MPs to turn up the one, you know, half hour of the week when it's their job to turn up and cheer for him, then he's got a real problem. And you can't really see that on TV. Sunak brought back his Windsor Agreement, that's what we're calling it, the new Northern deal. Windsor Framework. What was really striking in the room was that the cheers for him were, actually painful, ear-splittingly painful, in a way, you know, that when 350 people all yell quite close to you in a small space, it is. And I thought, gosh, I haven't heard that. Never heard it for Truss. You know, she never had them. Sunak hasn't had them. Boris Johnson did have them for a long time, but then, of course, because lockdown sort of constrained Parliament's ability to sit, basically you hadn't heard that since he won the election.
That's very interesting. Yes, yeah, you're right. And I haven't been in that much. Yeah. And I've forgotten. I mean, I remember it in the, you know, it used to be a feature of particularly budget speeches when the sound, the noise of it was so intense and the speaker would lose control. And because the leader of the opposition does the budget response, when I remember when Ed Miliband did it, there were occasions when, you know, he was just beaten by the crowd. He couldn't assert his authority over the sheer mob. I mean, going back to the Boris Johnson thing, I imagine that in your position, there's a source of ambivalence around someone like that because, bluntly speaking, he was just great material for a sketch writer. But also presumably the thing that makes him great material didn't make him a good prime minister. And as a citizen, are you torn between thinking, this is professionally great material for me, but for the country, I want him to go now, please?
I thought he was unfit to be prime minister. And again, one of the nice things about doing a sketch is you can more or less say that. Before I did this, I wrote for a long time for Bloomberg, where you couldn't say he's unfit to be prime minister. And actually, I think I would have found all of that very, very constraining because, you know, we've had bad prime ministers before. And we've had, or we've had, they're all bad prime ministers in the end, aren't they? You know,
why is that? Does the job just, is it the job selects the wrong people? Is it, someone recently told me, this is a digression, sorry, producer Phil.
No, it's fine.
We're going to digress. No, I'm not apologizing to you. I apologize to the producer who's sitting there going, Raph, why are you taking us off on this tangent? But it is quite interesting. The, I can apologize to you as well, Rob. Sorry, I don't want to be discourteous. But the, you know, I was talking to a former number 10 person who said, look, we had in Theresa May to an extent, in Boris Johnson to a large extent, in Liz Truss to an equally large extent, someone who not only was it obvious from the outside really to a lot of people that they couldn't do the job, and in the Johnson and Truss case, unfit to do the job, really. But the people around them who put them in the job knew that they were unfit for the job and did it anyway. And that's a really serious systemic problem, isn't it? With the way that democracy functions.
I was thinking about Theresa May this morning because I was reading something that her former chief of staff or co-chief of staff, Fiona Hill, had said about the fact that they were plotting to put her in the job from 2010. And I was thinking, why was she so bad at it then? And then actually, I remember the first year, it was not obvious that she was. I think in the first year, in the 2016 to 2017, basically up until the election, there were all sorts of things that you could point to that you go, I didn't handle that terribly. But there were other things where you thought, you know, she did all right. She handled that okay. I think partly we're really bad, and I mean, I include the political press in this, we're really bad at assessing what qualities someone needs. So, you know, there was sort of when someone like David Cameron comes along who's got the right kind of born to rule sort of air about him, he sort of talks right, he was good at lots of the bits of it, good at remembering people's names, good at being polite to opposition MPs, made a lot of the right noises about, you know, sort of not trying to be a demented sort of pursuer of the news media, but just trying to sort of mosey along, doing sensible things. And then, you know, you look back on the David Cameron era and you say, well, austerity was, you know, probably a mistake. Certainly sort of even from his side, the massive benefit cuts that they tried to bring in 2015 were a huge mistake. I mean, they were a huge mistake for him because they led to Brexit. So you can certainly make that case that a lot of
the anger that you stoked by basically making people feel they had the system was essentially making them poorer.
It created a time for a change moment. There were all sorts of silly things that they'd done that meant that when, as I think you used to put it, you know, when you then offered voters a button and said, if you're angry, you might like to press this, but we'd rather you didn't. And astonishingly, lots of people were angry with how the way that things were going, and they all pressed the button. And so Cameron falls. So at that point you think, okay, actually Cameron was quite bad at being prime minister. It looked like he was quite good at being prime minister. He seemed like a plausible kind of fellow. But actually he was rubbish at it because he blew himself up.
Right. Well, this is exactly the point that I want to kind of drill into here, because Cameron had all the perfect external presentations of someone who ought to have been, by the idiom of both the British establishment and political journalism's collective wisdom, a prime minister, a good prime minister. I remember him coming into the Observer one time and meeting, and the Observer's essentially full of liberal left-leaning people, and most of them weren't terribly impressed by David Cameron. But we came out of the meeting and I remember someone turning to me and saying, yeah, well, he's just got prime minister written all over him, hasn't he? When he was leader of the opposition, he was clearly going to win and he was clearly going to be prime minister. You know, where is the failing there from a journalistic point of view? You know, and we can be as self-critical as we like about this. That meant that the lobby in particular just has some evaluative sort of metric that isn't really looking at whether or not this is the right person to do the most important job in politics.
Some of it is, bluntly, there are newspapers that if they possibly can, are going to say that you ought to vote Conservative. And you know, people who work for those newspapers are broadly going to write the sorts of things that their editors will print and that their proprietors want to see printed. And I in a sense, actually, what they're going to do is write what readers want to read. The whole Fox News thing in the States, this is another tangent, but the fact that those presenters in the wake of the sort of January 6th, whatever it was, were saying, look, we're losing our viewers if we say that Trump lost the election. They are ultimately, even Fox News is following its audience. And my assumption is that people who buy the Daily Mail every day want to read the sorts of things that the Daily Mail prints. Why else would they? Just like people who read The Guardian want to read the sorts of things that The Guardian prints. And so that creates this sort of feedback loop where broadly, you know, as a news reporter, you know the sorts of things your readers are interested in. Even at Bloomberg, which is not, it wasn't partisan, you knew that your readers were interested in particular subjects. And so you made sure that you covered those subjects. And part of why did people write David Cameron up nicely was because he was the conservative candidate. You know, these are people who wrote Michael Howard up nicely. These are people who would have written Ian Duncan Smith up nicely. I have this dating theory of politics where the whole thing is about being on a date with somebody. And when you go on a date with somebody, you want to impress, you're sort of trying to do the look. If I were your boyfriend, you know, I would be the kind of person who turned up on time and who looked smart and had a shower and was interested in whatever it was that you wanted to talk about. You know, that's the kind of boyfriend I could be. And you know, maybe things get a bit further in as well. You know, if we got married, you know, I'd be the kind of person who could make enough money so that, you know, we could have a house and all of this kind of thing. And you're just, it's not conscious, but that is what we're all trying to do. And I think a good leader of the opposition is trying to do the same thing. If I were your prime minister, I'd be the kind of prime minister who would look good outside the door of number 10. You know, I wouldn't, and actually he was up against Gordon Brown. I wouldn't be the kind of prime minister who turned up at the White House with my trousers tucked into my socks for reasons that no one ever got to the bottom of. I wouldn't sort of wander off the stage. I wouldn't make us look stupid. And when David Cameron went to the White House, he looked tremendous. He did all of that fantastically well. But, you know, just like people are bad at choosing boyfriends and girlfriends, and indeed choosing spouses, we're quite bad at choosing leaders. So, I mean,
so there's it's hard to disentangle. There's so much a chicken and egg problem here, isn't there? That the media are saying, well, we like the cut of this person's jib and we think they are impressive and we write them up, setting aside the question of whether there's just an innate Fleet Street bias for the Tories, which, yeah, there obviously is in a section of the press. I think there is also a more kind of insidious cultural thing that, and I don't know if it happens in other countries as well, where the type of politician who develops a good relationship with the media brings a whole set of skills that are part of the glib kind of parlor game culture. It's not just that you're good at presentation, it's that you're good at gaming the lobby. You're good at gaming the game of being good at politics. And too many of those journalists, ourselves included sometimes, who are in Westminster all the time, think that writing up who's winning that game is also writing up who's good at politics. And they might not be the same thing. In fact, they probably aren't the same thing.
I really notice it whenever you read someone saying that someone's an effective minister. And I just, whenever I see that, I think, well, gosh, how do we know? You know, I mean, we know when someone's an ineffective minister. I think that we can say that Gavin Williamson was not a very effective education secretary at a point when it might have been quite nice to have one. I was just talking to a diplomat the other day who sort of, I asked them how they felt about keeping James Cleverly. And they said, oh, we really like him. He's really good. And part of that is apparently that he just, not all of his predecessors have been particularly interested in doing diplomacy, and James Cleverly is quite good at that. Part of it may simply be, in a sense, what a civil servant means by he's a good minister in a Sir Humphreyish way is he does what I tell him. I give him the three options with one of them in bold saying, I mean, you could do those, but this is what I'd like you to do. And he takes advice. And I can see from, you know, just all of us who have been managed, that's what we value in a manager is ultimately somebody who takes our advice. Whether that actually makes them an effective manager or not, you know, often it does. It's so hard because a lot of it is about, are you a good leaker? You know, are you somebody who's a good luncher? Have you sort of made excellent contact? So there was certainly in the late Theresa May era, there was a period where I think pretty much everyone in the lobby had a pretty good idea of who was leaking to everyone else. And we were all engaged in this slightly sort of frantic lunching schedule of trying to meet cabinet ministers and say, hey, I understand that you're basically putting it out there. If you ever want to put it to me, I will take your leaks too. Certainly when I see a political editor write that so-and-so is an effective minister, there's a part of my brain that very cynically says, oh, he's your source. You mean he briefs you?
Yeah, at some point, presumably, and well, in fact, we know that there is a tension that arises. If someone has been a very reliable source and good fount of information, and they are then the center of the story, a decision has to be made. Well, I'm going to have to burn this contact because, you know, I have to write up what a terrible person they are, or just that they've done this bad thing that means they should probably resign, which is unfortunate for me because then they're no longer going to be at the cabinet table giving me information. And you know, it's obvious what the right thing to do in that situation is. I imagine not everyone does the right thing every time.
I certainly can recall when Damien McBride was when that plane was crashing into the ground in the Brown era, that there were political editors who had an awful lot of good stuff from him who were very, very, very reluctant to do the story. I mean, to counterexample, I would be astonished if Matt Hancock, who is an extremely savvy, media savvy cabinet minister, who clearly sort of before everything blew up, thought of himself as a future prime minister.
They all think of themselves as future prime ministers, don't they?
But Matt Hancock really, I'd be astonished if Matt Hancock, and I should say, one never reveals anyone else's sources or your own sources. I have no idea, but I would be astonished if he had not maintained good relations with Harry Cole, who is the political editor of the Sun. You would be daft if you wanted those things. I'm sure that you try and have a good relationship with one of the most important journalists in your world. And yet, you know, when Harry Cole is handed pictures of Matt Hancock up against his office door, the Sun still ran the story. So people ultimately are willing to throw their contacts overboard.
Yeah, that's a rational calculation. I mean, that's a huge, enormous story. And if you're the political editor of the Sun, whoever the next Tory minister is, they're going to want to have a relationship with you. So the power there is not necessarily with the minister.
Yeah. I think that does help. The press becomes the kind of the permanent opposition. So yes, you know, the new health secretary will also take your calls.
But, you know, it is a famous, you know, as was it Stanley Baldwin said, you know, power without responsibility, the prerogative of the harlot through the ages, whatever. That sense that, I mean, I would like to think that we are the fourth estate pillar of a liberal democratic order, and that, you know, therefore, and that function, you know, brings with it all sorts of ethical obligations that we fulfill out of a sense of duty, and obviously shouldn't need regulating because that would be an affront to the freedom of the press. That's the principle, right? What slightly worries me, and I find a bit distasteful, and have done when you spend too much time in the lobby, is the sense that there is a tension between the need for proximity to actually know what the story is. You need to have intimacy enough to actually know what's going on in politics, but without complicity. And I'm not sure how easy it is to police that boundary. I mean, is there a point at which, to be good enough at the insider journalism, you have to become an insider and then you become a courtier? How do you be an insider but not a courtier?
I don't think everyone manages that, frankly. I was never that much of an insider. At the point at which I was working for Bloomberg, no one was really that fussed about keeping Bloomberg on board in the way that they were fussed about keeping the Sun on board or the Mail. Temperamentally, I am a lot happier being a sketch writer and telling people that what they've just said is ridiculous than I am at nodding and saying to them, oh yes, you know, that's very, very sensible, very wise. That's obviously the solution. Someone like Michael Gove makes the jump, you know, and goes from being a courtier on the outside to being an actual courtier. James Forsyth of The Spectator has just sort of made this jump. He's a very old friend of Rishi Sunak's, and Rishi Sunak asked him to come and work for him, so he did, and he indeed may be more comfortable being inside Downing Street helping Sunak, his old friend, than sitting at The Spectator and The Times trying to write critically about one of his closest friends. I can see that would be very awkward.
Yeah, but the extraordinary thing about that is there was also a period where he had his cake and ate it, you know, where he was still a political editor of The Spectator and writing columns for The Times, while actually his oldest school friend was Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know. And one of the interesting things about the Matt Hancock WhatsApp messages is that exchange with his old friend and mentor, George Osborne, says, "Can I have the splash on the Standard, please?" And George Osborne goes, yeah, I think we can do that for you. I can basically write a favourable front page for the government. Why not? And you think, well, obviously, like, there are lots of words you could apply to that. I mean, essentially, it's corrupt, isn't it? I mean, from a journalistic point of view, that was not George Osborne doing what an editor of a newspaper ought to do by the rules of journalistic integrity, as you or I might understand them, right? So that was just corrupt from a journalistic point of view.
I don't know I would necessarily use the word corrupt. I certainly think that George Osborne ought to be embarrassed.
Would you not use the word corrupt because there might be a legal problem with using the word corrupt? In which case, should I say, obviously, there is no evidence that George Osborne has done anything wrong.
No, I don't. Well, it's not so much that. I suppose I just think, in a sense, if you have somebody with George Osborne as editor of the Standard, none of us ever thought that George Osborne was anything other than a Tory at the point at which he was editing the Standard, if you see what I mean. The interesting thing was the extent to which he was willing to run stories that were hostile to the Tories. Now, it's partly, obviously, because he didn't like Theresa May.
Well, but again, that's a readership point. London readers vote Labour. I mean, it's madness that London's main newspaper was this Tory paper.
I mean, look, all of us would be embarrassed if our WhatsApp messages were published. Largely, of course, to journalists. It's catty things that we've said about other journalists.
Speak for yourself, Rob. I would never indulge in that. So one hears that such a thing goes on, so...
I'm told that that's the sort of thing that other people do in WhatsApp. Would you be really embarrassed? Would you feel like, actually, do you know what, professionally, this compromises me? My slight issue with George Osborne is I'm not sure that he would, he does feel as embarrassed as he ought to feel about that Hancock exchange.
Well, that's, I suppose, when I say that's probably what I meant by corrupt, I meant it more as in a kind of moral and biological sense, a kind of a rottenness, that there's a kind of a decay there of the system as it's supposed to work.
At that level, I guess the thing is that basically having George Osborne in that job was an example of that, that you should pick one or pick the other. When I was at Bloomberg, I would not have been allowed, if my best man, you know, my best man, my oldest friend had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, basically they would have said, look, you need to go and write about companies or something. You can't still be writing about this guy because nobody will trust what you're writing. And there were, you know, I mean, you couldn't have dated somebody who was working in Downing Street or anything like that. All of that would have been just completely sort of...
That is, so there's two issues here. One is there's a milieu problem, that it's just a small, yeah, there, yeah, it people knocking around the same, they went, a lot of them went to the same schools, went to the same university, go to the same parties. Although the UK is a big country, Westminster is, as the metaphor always has it, a village. And so, you know, there's a sort of, and a revolving door of people who've been special advisors, or people rather who've been political editors or journalists going on to be special advisors, poachers turned gamekeepers and then poacher again. So that's one problem that I suspect is probably common to a lot of political cultures, because if you're interested in politics, you're more interested in that than you are perhaps in being a journalist. So ultimately, if you get the opportunity to be even more inside, you might take it. That's one problem. And then the other problem, which is, I mean, going back to what you're saying about, does George Osborne think there was anything wrong with what he did? And that is the problem of shamelessness, that the sense that whatever it is that we think is the parameter that is an ethical line that people might or might not want to cross, it's only policed in your conscience, ultimately. And so if you simply don't have that line in your conscience, then does the parameter exist?
The milieu one is so interesting. I had never felt awkward about the fact that I didn't go to Oxford until I went and started working in the lobby. And just...
Oh, sorry, Rob. I'm going to have to stop you there. I didn't realise you didn't go to Oxford, so that's podcast over.
I know. Sorry. It's just... We're now sufficiently old that I'm now kind of in the university application zone for my children. And you think about all sorts of things, but I'm aware that there's this little voice in my mind that says they have to try to go to Oxford because everyone goes to Oxford. And 20 years ago, I didn't think that. But everyone I work with seems to have seems to have gone to Oxford and to have known each other at Oxford, and very often went out with each other at Oxford. And you're sitting there thinking, I'm very much a son of middle class privilege. I've had a very, very happy home country's upbringing. Went to a great Russell Group University in Edinburgh. Had a fantastic time, but you do suddenly realize that actually this tiny group of people do all seem to have been living with each other for the last two or three decades. And that affects all sorts of things. Like, there's a very good piece by James Kirkup in the Times this week. We're talking about which universities really help social mobility. And his point was that Queen Mary University of London in East London does far more for social mobility because it takes a whole load of kids from East London who were never going to go to Oxford and educates them and gives them degrees and they go on to do great things. And
I agree. It was a really interesting piece again, because he also made the point that actually the universities that serve people who don't go away from home, people who who go to their local university, which is very much not the model of the conception of what university experience is supposed to be for, you know, when we were growing up, you know, the sort of elite and the upper middle class tier that went off to grand sounding universities. That was the conception of what it was supposed to be. Are boosting the local economy and helping turn parts of the country that might otherwise not have much going for them into places that might have something going for them because they've got a great university there.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Aside from the sort of Oxbridge element of it, there is a set of codes and idioms and a lifestyle that goes around being in Westminster that also, and that sort of narrates itself as distinct and that almost gets a kick out of the way in which it is like the thick of it. Even it became more like the thick of it by having watched the thick of it and deciding to become more like that. Do you know what I mean? There's this sort of iterative process where, or, you know, with a bit of throwing a bit of like, aren't we in the West Wing? Well, no, you're just in a horrible damp room on a committee corridor. It's really not at all like the West Wing. But that sense that in their own minds, people are performing something that's so distinctly political, both as lobby journalists and special advisors, they are more one tribe than they are opposing sides of something. And they ought to be slightly opposing sides.
Almost inevitably, a group of people who work in one geographic location on broadly similar salaries, working broadly similar hours, will tend to end up finding them their minds, especially if they all went to, you know, broadly similar universities, will find their minds all moving in broadly similar ways. Vivid memory about 2009 when Gordon Brown had announced they were getting rid of some child tax credit thing or other.
It was a 10p tax, wasn't it? He kept the tax credits.
This is much worse.
You'll remember better than me, sorry.
This story. So they were getting rid of the thing that I could use as a parent of small children and a then higher rate taxpayer to buy childcare vouchers. And it was basically a tax break for people who were on the 40% rate to pay for childcare. And they were getting rid of it for, you know, for perfectly good reasons that if times are tight, you take from the rich first. But what they had failed to grasp was that this was the one bit of childcare tax policy that the entire lobby understood because we were all using it. I remember the conference briefing where the guy who was trying to answer questions about it, where I think the guy who was trying to answer questions about it wasn't using it and was facing 30 irate, and I have to say men, all of whom you know, were ticking this box on their tax form every year, and it was worth a few hundred quid. But, you know, and we'd all gone, and you had to jump through some hoops to take care of it, and then you had to sort of hand it to your provider and this kind of thing. And so I just remember thinking, gosh, this is awful, because there are all sorts of things that they're doing that we don't understand.
Of all the things that the lobby knows inside out and, you know, has expertise in, benefits policy as applies to people who aren't higher rate taxpayers is not one of them, in my experience. There's a very weak argument.
Completely.
In the same way that I think, you know, I can't believe we've managed to avoid the subject for so long, but yeah, you know, I don't think Brexit might not have happened if the lobby had known about how the EU works and what it actually is in the same level of insider detail that it knows about how domestic UK politics is and how it works. So there were things that were said to certain journalists who wrote them up as splashes in supposedly very serious newspapers that in the order of, you know, the German car makers will come to our rescue and give us a, you know, tell Angela Merkel to give us a great deal. That genre of opinion, briefed from number 10, that whatever the English, the UK political equivalent of that assertion would have been something like, oh, it's okay, we can, you know, for the Tories to say, oh, it's okay, we could afford to lose Mid-Bedfordshire because we're going to win Islington North. It's like, no, you're not.
Yes.
That's just not, anyone who knows how this works knows that's simply not true. That's a stupid thing to say. But because it was about Europe, but it was in the lobby, the level of ignorance of what constituted a serious thing to say and what constituted just a stupid thing to say that clearly no one should believe, the guardrails weren't there.
Yeah.
Is that unfair?
Yeah, no, totally. No, that's totally. So Brexit coverage was fascinating to work for Bloomberg doing Brexit coverage, because Bloomberg has a proper bureau in Brussels that understands Brussels. I think some of Bloomberg's Brussels correspondents are the best in the business. So very, very plugged in. Just understood the dynamics of it. Used to reporting it from all sorts of countries. And we also had a bureau in every one of the capitals. So when somebody said, oh, well, the Italians think this, we had somebody in Italy who could tell us whether the Italians really did think this.
Whether they were really thinking, it's okay, we want to sell Prosecco, so you can have your cake and eat it in the single market. Guess what?
No. Yes, yeah, you know, and somebody who bluntly knew who the Italian Prime Minister was, whereas British newspapers had all broadly got rid of their Brussels correspondents, or if they'd kept them, the job of Brussels correspondent had been one of the first things that Boris Johnson corrupted, was the role of Brussels correspondent. So it was no longer sort of somebody who understood what was going on in Brussels and told you about it. It was somebody whose job it was to provide sort of massively entertaining stories about lunatic Europeans. And that person is not the person who is going to say this is all rubbish. And I was very conscious throughout the sort of the Brexit period that you would see splashes in papers that were sort of the Europeans are going to do this, that were briefed from London. And I gave up even calling Brussels to say this is bollocks, isn't it? Because they would just say they're not. We know what we know what the Europeans are going to do because they've told us and they've said it in public. And there's obviously sometimes people say things in public that aren't actually what they're actually going to do in private. And indeed, sometimes that was the case with Brussels. Let's be clear. You know, they're not saints in all of this, but broadly what happened was what Brussels, you know, was that was what they said would happen.
Yeah.
There were no, if you were paying attention in 2016, there were no huge surprises in 2019.
One of the remarkable things about that process was that I think and I've heard this from people who used to work at the Foreign Office and now don't, and people on the European side will say that a mistake that was made in Brussels was looking at some of that stuff and thinking, well, this is obviously a game that's being played and it's a bit annoying and parochial and trivial, but clearly the UK is ultimately a serious country and it's a G7 country and there are grown-up ministers who have risen to the top of their game and these are serious newspapers. Somewhere in this mechanism, there are people who know this isn't true and they have a beg, this is all part of a plan. And then they would meet the ministers who would come to Brussels and they would, the EU side would go, wow. No, you actually think this is true. You say this stuff because you believe it. And they write this stuff because they really don't understand. And that was quite shocking, you know, for them to think, oh no, you did this thing in this referendum, There really is no plan. You're not being clever. It's exactly as stupid as it looks.
You and I can and have talked about Brexit all night, but this goes much wider than that. I mean, how many sort of political journalists, how many journalists generally live in a block of flats? It was a really big issue after Grenfell, where it's just like, I didn't grow up in flats. I've never lived in a tower block. So I have no idea what you're exposed to do if you're in a block of flats and it catches fire. It's just, and I don't think I'm unusual in the sort of in the political class. Obviously, race is, you know, I mean, the media has got more diverse than it was when I came in, but I do remember vividly sort of 30, 25 years ago, when there was a meningitis outbreak, and the popular tabloid newspaper I was working for at the time did one of these, how to tell if the rash is meningitis or not. You have to press a cold glass against it, and you know, and it's whether the skin turns pink or whatever. And I, after it had gone to press, someone said, I wonder how it works for black skin. Because there was no one in the office, barely anyone in the office who had children with black skin. Well, I'm sure to say this is not malicious. It's not that we on the paper sort of didn't care what happened to black children. It's that nobody had thought, if, as it were, a black-skinned person had been involved in any stage of the production of that piece, they would have said,
this doesn't apply. Yeah.
And there's just lots of stuff like that where it's not malicious. It's not, and I think people get this idea that the lobby is a conspiracy and so on. And obviously there are all sorts of bits of it that are, but a lot of it is thoughtless, which is not an excuse. You know, I don't think there's anyone in the lobby who is racist to the point where they would not care, you know, what happened to children of a different race. And I don't think there's anyone in the lobby who's sort of so awful that they don't care about people in tower blocks. I don't actually think there's anyone in Parliament, very few people in Parliament, who just don't care about people in tower blocks. They can see, you know, it, MPs and even the richest constituencies have to deal with proper poverty.
Yeah, see, no, exactly. As sometimes, I mean, this is, and here I will be a bit more critical, perhaps, or less generous to our profession in that sense. I mean, there are some awful, awful MPs. There's no question. And the standard has, I think, it's hard to judge. You know, policemen always look younger and all the rest of it. So are they worse now than they ever were? I don't know. I think there are some really very, very bad ones in at the moment. But that said, most MPs, especially if they don't have a huge majority, have to engage at constituency level with things that lobby journalists in particular don't, you know, they don't. So yeah, they just doing constituency surgery. So housing issues in particular, your constituency surgery will force an MP to be aware of things, to have a broader horizon. So the charge that's often leveled about being out of touch, MPs do often know better.
And you saw that a bit actually when Liz Truss was sort of talking about cutting benefits last year, and you know, lots of Tory MPs with majorities under 10,000 said, you've got to be kidding, you know, that's me losing my seat. So, but what there is, having offered that defense, there is often a thoughtlessness. We tend to write about the things that we understand and that we care about.
A lot of what we've described is very dysfunctional. And what I'm wary of is the point where dysfunctionality can shade into jaundiced conspiracy theory. So people listening to this might think, this is the most appalling thing ever. You basically, you're all drinking and shagging together and scratching each other's backs, and how can anyone read what's in the papers? Whereas the reality is, I read the papers, and the good ones, often there's things that people write where it is true, it really is, and actually incredibly insightful, and I learn things about what's going on. So, you know, you were right to pull me up earlier on the word corrupt. You know, it's not a conspiracy.
Okay, so when Gordon Brown took over, Damien McBride had this brilliant plan where he was going to deal with, I think it was 5 or 6 political editors, and he'd got the Telegraph on board, he'd got the Mail on board for Gordon Brown. It was impressive to watch. And I remember sitting there, I mean, I actually remember walking down the street and seeing him coming out of a lunch with the political editor Telegraph, and they were both very, you know, smiling warmly. And I thought, I'm never going to get anything from this lot. So I'm going to have to make my own news, as it were. I'm going to have to find other sources. Damien has picked his insiders, and not only am I not in them, I'm not even in the room next door to the insiders. And that was the problem that he found, actually, was whereas when you were running the Treasury, you basically dealt with one reporter from each outlet and you slightly had them over a barrel because they needed things from you around budget time and various sort of autumn statement time, various points where they couldn't completely burn you. Although, to be fair, you know, there are some very good economics editors out there. You come and deal with the lobby. And you say, right, I've got 6 lobby journalists in my pocket. The only problem you then have is the 350 who aren't in your pocket, who realize that they're not going to get anything from you and who say, right, better blow you up then. And all of those guys who are good at their jobs and hungry, and they go out and they find the cracks in the system and they find the people within Whitehall, which is not a monolith. It's a sort of facade full of cracks. They find the unhappy people and they talk to them and they say, well, you know, you're unhappy, I can help, why don't you pour your heart out, tell me what it is you're unhappy about. And so the way I don't think the system works perfectly, and I do think the system has huge biases, but actually the way that the system does work is that there is always a reporter who will take your story. That, you know, it may be that the Mail won't take your story, but the Mirror will, or it may be that the Mirror won't take your story, but the Telegraph will. So that is the way that the system rarely works well on any given day, but in aggregate, it does work.
Well, and Boris Johnson, I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. I mean, not that long ago that it looked like Boris Johnson had just done something so extraordinary and beguiled and mesmerized his own party, and also large.
He was squatting, I think, like a giant toad. Tim gets upset when people quote that.
And those of us who were watching thinking, this man is unfit to do the job, and what he's doing is terrible. He's systemically corrupting the process of politics, yeah, by lying about it and just pretending that problems can be solved by declaring them solved and all that stuff. Starting to think, well, when does he get found out? How much more of this do you need to see before it becomes just an accepted fact? And it did. Actually, you know, he exploded in precisely the way that someone who tells too many lies and can't keep all the plates spinning would be expected to explode.
Yeah.
But it was newspapers that did that. Well, and ITV.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, no, but so you can always find the cracks in the system. And I mean, it took longer with Boris than I would have liked it to have taken, but it happened. So yeah, that would be my cause for hope. And there are, in fact, sort of, again, compared to when you and I started this 25 odd years ago, where everything was really in the hands of the newspapers, there's just been this massive sort of democratization of news outlets. So, you know, I mean, there are all of these little sort of Open Democracy and Byline Times and this sort of thing, that little outfits. And when they get a story, everybody else follows it, because actually, although, you know, there are all sorts of things that are not great about our news media, but there is a muscle reflex for news, ultimately, that if somebody has a good story, we'll run it. You know, even they'll tone it down. The Mail sort of tried to get Currygate going as an alternative to Partygate and so on, but it's not like the Mail didn't report Partygate. They sort of reported it in their own particular way, but ultimately, you know, they still ran the photos. They may have said these photos don't really show anyone having a party, but the photos were still there and readers could take their own views.
I mean, going back to actually where I started about the role that trying to be funny or satire or parody has in this, there ought to be one of the mechanisms that contains someone like Boris Johnson. Was he just sort of beyond parody because self-parodizing was part of his shtick?
He was quite hard to parody. I mean, you know, I don't think I had him giving his dad a knighthood in a sketch, but you know, it's definitely the kind of thing that I might have thought to make up for something. And then he goes and does it. And there's this odd thing when you're doing the sketch where on the days when he's at his worst, people will say to you, oh, this stuff writes itself. And you go, no, it doesn't. It really doesn't. Because actually you have to sort of find some way to convey just how awful whatever it is that he's said and done. You know, the sort of the Standards Committee produced their interim report, which basically said, you know, he must have known that there were parties and he must have seen the parties. He must have known that you couldn't have parties.
He in fact said at one point, oh dear, we're having too many parties.
Yes. Out and said, this report clears me. And you just thought, it really doesn't. I mean, there is no honest reading. There's just no honest reading of that report that clears you. And he's always been an admirer of Trump's. You know, you could see from 2016, there was a little sort of, ooh, I'm interested to see that that works.
And you've written very well in one of your earlier books about the sort of the spin and lies and political sort of journalese, the idiom of it. And it's a great book, and it really deconstructs something about the way that politics expresses itself to itself, but predicated also on the idea that what you're trying to do is say something that might be technically true, but it's not in the spirit of truth, you know. So, you know, I can't, the classic one that always springs to mind is, you know, you could say, and, you know, IDS and George Osborne often did say that a quarter of the whole budget is benefits, which makes it sound like you're spending a lot of money on people sitting at home drinking strong lager in the middle of the day, watching large flat screen TVs they didn't pay for. Actually, it's pensions, right? That's the reason it's such a big money. The number is pensions. So it's not untrue what you said, but there's an awful lot of spin and deception and deviance. You get the point. What Boris Johnson, what Trump understood, and that what Boris Johnson, I think, then, you know, had also understood but had seen work was, well, what if you just snap the elastic? Mm. Right? What if you don't even try to find something that still has some tether to something that you could call the truth?
Yeah.
And the answer is nothing. You get away with it.
I wrote a book called Would They Lie to You, which embarrassingly has a Boris Johnson quote on the cover. It sort of came out, I think, in about 2014. And it was just before the answer to this question turned out to be yes, they would lie to you. And it was all sort of predicated on how do you get around. I called it uncommunication. How do you get from having something you don't really want to say to having something you haven't quite said? Embarrassingly, I can say at a distance, the best bit of the book was the introduction, which was written by Matthew Paris, in which he said that he wished that I had written more about people who just lie. And the book is sort of worth reading for the introduction. Oh, the book is worth reading because I need to feed my children. But the introduction, it turned out to be incredibly prescient about Trump and Boris. Because it's just, what do you do with people who just look you in the eye and say, but I didn't do that. There were no parties. You know, I never knew about you or whatever it is. You know, I didn't, I'm not in this podcast. I never made that recording. Our sort of human psychological assumption is, well, you know, he wouldn't say, people don't just lie, do they? You know, and of course the answer is some people, mostly they don't. You know, mostly they're deeply uncomfortable lying. Not just Boris and Trump. Theresa May, there were a few moments where she would say things that just like she, I mean, I remember once she said to me, I never said that. And I thought, well, you really did say that. I've got the transcript in front of me of you saying this. And it wasn't just an offhand remark. This was, I was asking her about something she'd said outside Downing Street, you know, at a podium. It was a proper, so there is this thing of just blunt denial, and it's actually in a way, I think satire is better at it. I think satire was better at Boris than news reporting was. So certainly, sort of the kind of news reporting I did at Bloomberg, where the assumption is essentially was good faith all the way through. I am a good faith writer. I am writing about good faith people. You are good faith readers, and there's a vulnerability in that chain if somebody is just simply not telling the truth. Theresa May was the first time we had a crack at it, was with, if you remember the 2017 election when the U-turn, the nothing has changed moment. And the way that we wrote that up was nothing has changed, the Prime Minister said after announcing the change, nothing has changed. I thought because it was a change. She had changed her policy. Everybody knew that she had changed her policy. And I just thought the only way that I could do this is just to put her words next to, but, you know,
the New York Times and the Washington Post found this with Trump, and I can't remember what solution they came up with. In the end, they sort of ran fact checked alongside the news reporting. Mm. But ultimately, to accuse someone of lying generally has been considered in the environment, you're not allowed to do it on the floor of the House of Commons. It's closer to, or has traditionally been closer to, abuse and invective than an analytical statement. Mm. But, you know, with Boris Johnson, it's a statement of fact. So, you know, if you say the Prime Minister said this thing and it is a lie, that's not something that straight reporters are sort of allowed to do by their craft. But if you don't say it's a lie, then you're already ceding too much terrain to the lie.
Yes, and well, I mean, it's interesting. In the Commons, Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker, came closer and closer to allowing MPs to accuse each other, to accuse Boris Johnson of lying. And it, not so much to accuse each other, but with Boris Johnson, there were this formulation that Labour landed on, which is people will think this is a lie. Now, I don't think that he would have allowed that with a good faith Prime Minister. I think he took the view that broadly people would think this was a lie because it was.
And again, the optimistic view, because we do like to finish the podcast on an optimistic note, and we have run out of time, is that it's not a totalitarian society. The raw will and power of the great helmsman does not just decide what is truth and what is falsehood. There were objective facts, and they came out, and Boris Johnson was undone by the truth about what he'd done and about who he was and who he is. And the group of Conservative MPs who are still in denial about that feel to me increasingly marginal. That might be optimistic, overly optimistic, but I think actually factuality reasserted itself from the bog of post-truth politics more thoroughly than seemed likely in 2019.
Ultimately, the system worked. Ultimately, you know, journalism did its job. Ultimately, reluctantly, MPs did their job. And indeed, I think Tory MPs are going to pay a price for the years of Boris. And they're going to pay a price in two ways. First of all, I think they're going to pay a price because there are a lot of people who are revolted by them. And one of the reasons they're revolted by them is because they've had this awful man lying for years on end in charge of them. And partly, even people who don't care about that, which probably is most people, he promised all sorts of things without any plan about how to deliver them. And now Rishi Sunak is stuck trying to work out how to deliver on these, you know, on these promises and these implied promises. I mean, you know, one of the big implied promises is that, you know, sort of life in the north of England would look better in 2024 than it did in 2019. Not clear to me that's going to be delivered because he had no plan to deliver it. And I hope that the system works. Pessimistically, he's off making far more money than you or I or anyone listening to this podcast. You know, he'll be fine.
On the satire point, the final point, yeah, then, because this is where we started. Do you worry that this isn't an optimistic point, actually, so we might need to change the orders. But do you worry that doing parody and satirizing these people, there is a kind of an indulgence there that almost sort of lets them off the hook. In the same way that the reporter can't say the Prime Minister lied today, the satirist you can't be angry enough because you're trying to also contain it in humour.
I think you can. I think sometimes you can be caustic. I mean, I actually try not to just be ranty. I don't know that I always succeed, but I try, one of the things I tried to remember is that everyone is the hero of their own narrative, and everyone at some level generally probably thinks that what they're trying to do is the right or the reasonable thing to do. And you have to explain why. I want people to understand why it is that the Home Office has adopted the small boats policy that it has, because there is clearly somebody in government to whom this seems reasonable. And I think you can also say, well, there are big problems with it, while trying not to be. I suppose what I'm trying to say is I don't think there's any value in saying, oh, well, it's just because Suella Braverman's wicked, you know, and evil, you know, and I think you have to be more, you have to try and be more interesting than that. But the ability to mock, to somehow to prick the bubble. I mean, actually, one of the most successful things I wrote was about Boris Johnson's unfortunate habit of scratching his ass the whole time. Somebody else who won't want to be attributed pointed out to me that he does this. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. His hand is always back down the back of his trousers.
And the front of his trousers as well, I would say, on occasion.
And yeah, well, other people's hands are down the front of his trousers. It's not so much that particularly conflicted with his image of himself, because obviously he is a scruff, but there was just something about, you know, sort of the way that he would sort of try to, he does see himself as a sort of Churchillian figure. So he does, there's something about him, you know, that although he's scruffy, he also sees himself as a sort of great visionary leader of men. And the ability to just, you know, truthfully say that as he delivered this particular point, he, you know, he gave his ass a fantastic sort of 10-second scratch. like a cartoonist or something, it just enabled you to say this is to prick the bubble somehow.
No, so it's a good analogy. The cartoonists, the best ones, like the best sketch writers, and you're definitely in their number, foremost among them, in my view, can aggravate and aggress against the vanity of people in power in a way that straight writing, straight reporting and polemic can't, because polemic puts people on their guard and polemic serves people who sort of agree with it already. Whereas what you do and what the cartoonists do is they can make a truth undeniable even to the people who would rather not believe it. And that's my answer to the question. I think that's where its power is. And I think you are very good at that.
Well, thank you. I try.
And on that, that's an optimistic note on which we can...
That is an optimistic note, yeah, there we are.
Which we can finish the podcast. So thanks very much, Rob, for coming on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure to join you.
Thanks again to Rob Hutton, parliamentary sketch writer at The Critic magazine, which is also online at thecritic.co.uk. He also co-hosts a podcast with Duncan Weldon called A Pod Too Far, where they watch old war movies and discuss why they love them and what it tells us about the British psyche. I assume they don't watch them in real time, otherwise that'd be a very long podcast. No, of course they don't. They watch them before they go onto the podcast and make a few notes on the scrap of paper. So I guess it's a bit like Match of the Day with no football, although they have reviewed Escape to Victory, so that's one which does have football in. Anyway, I digress here. I'm reliably informed, by Rob to be precise, that they will be back in the studio to record a new season shortly. But in the meantime, there's at least a dirty dozen to listen to. See what I did there? In fact, that's one of the films they've discussed. So as the podster hipsters like to say, go check it out. Anyway, back to Politics on the Couch, and thanks must also go to you, the audience, for making it this far, and all your lovely comments. Yes, we do still receive them, even though we've been off air for quite a while now. Well, 6 weeks, 6 weeks or so. We'll be back for one more before our summer break. I'm Phil the producer saying, until next time, bye.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.